The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovitz, here with my ever effervescent co-host, the only man to give a complete electrical engineering lecture in Klingon, Bill Hunt. Do you speak Klingon?
No, but, you know, actually, I once accidentally found, I was looking for the Kerr L. White Institute, which funds biomedical stuff, and I put a, supposed to be KLWI, and I just put KLI.
And you got Klingon?
The Klingon Language Institute.
And you can, send them your resume immediately.
You can actually go study Klingon. You can send your kids to Klingon summer camp.
Well, is it like Latin, right? It's a dead language, but there's a lot of entomology, or entomins, you know, the history of words.
It's not entomology, I can tell you that. Okay. We talked about that when, you know, when Tannenbaum was here.
Okay.
Entomology, but, sorry, but yeah.
Okay, all right, so let's start right with the title of today's show, which is What's in the Water? We'll be talking with our guest, Professor Larry Bottomley from the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry here at Georgia Tech, about analytical chemistry. For those of you who don't know what that is, and he's going to define it for us in a moment, it's what they do on CSI. Probably the only branch of chemistry that has its only cool drama show, which is neat. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So let's see, after doing his bachelor's degree at Cal State Fullerton and his PhD at University of Houston in chemistry, he spent some time on the faculty at Florida State University. And now is here at Georgia Tech and has been here for quite some time, bothering me just down the hall. So, Larry, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Pete. Bill?
So, Bill, do we have any science
yes,
in the news?
Yes, you've got to point out he's also an accomplished sculptor.
He is indeed. And, in fact, has written a proposal to do a living learning community here at Georgia Tech on three-dimensional sculpture next fall.
Cool.
And we're hopeful that the proposal gets funded and students will be interested.
Right. Great. Yet another illustration that scientists and engineers aren't all geeks.
We know how to throw down. Yeah.
All right. So before you start with science and news, let me remind people that in case you've got an interesting question about what is in the water, CSI, all sorts of stuff, and this very interesting thing we're going to talk about later about astronauts drinking their own urine, which, you know, is good that we're a lunchtime show. by all means, if you've got a question or comment.
This is from a guy who just had his pizza.
The second half of the show, if you've got a question or comment, give us a call at 404-894-2468. Or if you're listening on the web at www.wrek.org, that number is listed on the webpage. So, Bill, science in the news.
Science in the news from the International Herald Tribune. A whisper, perhaps, from the universe's dark side. A concatenation of puzzling results from an alphabet soup of satellites and experiments has led a growing number of astronomers and physicists to suspect that they are getting signals from a shadow universe of dark matter that makes up a quarter of creation, but has eluded direct detection until now. So, in essence, they think they're starting to see what they had was a high-altitude balloon that detected both positive and negative, positively charged particles and matter, antimatter for that. And they think it's dark matter crashing into each other someplace out there in the universe.
So evidence of what they're trying to find out at the Large Hadron Collider in the corner of Switzerland that Eric Prebis talked to us about a couple months ago.
Yep, and so they're, you know, they're looking at what experiment, but they're baffled by it. They don't know what it is. So they're thinking it, you know, they're trying to tie it back into you know, Einsteinian's dream of unified theory and what's the dark matter and all this kind of stuff. So it's there are so many theories floating around on this. It's just kind of weird. They're just coming up with weird stuff.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen. The technical term was finally evoked. Kind of weird. I'm going to leave it
it's so early, they don't have any idea what they're looking at.
Oh, okay.
And they don't, you know, they think it's dark matter. They're not really sure. And so the theorists, I mean, they're having a good time.
Okay. Well, you know, that's why we all go into science. And I think later in the show, Larry's going to point out to us that, you know, you use a technique, a pH meter, some analytical instrument. But what we oftentimes forget is that measurement assumes there's no interference by other phenomena and other things in there. It's more complicated than you think. People mm-hmm. that think that chemistry or physics is simply reading a number off an instrument, mm-hmm. it's just not that case. I think that's a common reoccurring theme yeah. that we have there. Before we actually...
Well, I was going to say, they're looking for the missing mass, which, of course, Rosie O'Donnell is looking for missing mass.
I thought you were the missing well. Mass, actually.
Oh, but sorry.
Apparently it's not enough to explain the
someday we'll be able to afford a rim shot, you know, a little drum
yeah,
machine
can we,
in here.
As always, ladies and gentlemen, Trent Altman, working the big board for us today. What do you got? Is this the Seattle grunge look with the hat today?
I don't know. It's cold outside.
Okay.
Well, here, okay.
Can we get a rim shot? If I brought you in a rim shot on like a CD or something?
Maybe an actual drum.
Yeah, I still don't think that deserved a rim shot, though.
Okay, so all right.
Not rim shot worthy? Okay.
Because no. That's my role, right?
Well, here's one other thing. So this is in the category of analogies that should have never been made. So this is the same article. You could think of it as a hamster running around on a wheel in its cage. We cannot see the hamster or the cage, but we can sort of feel the impact of the hamster running. You know, at least it wasn't gerbils. Einsteinian, according to Einsteinian relativity, its momentum in the extra dimension would register as a mass in our own space-time. Why bring hamsters into this? Why rodents?
I believe that's Schrödinger's hamster. And if you get that joke, you are a real geek.
He actually had a cat. I don't think Schrödinger actually ever had a hamster.
You know,
I
was reaching here.
Anyway, I thought that was nothing like making an analogy that makes people go, "What in the world? hamster?"
And if my daughter's listening, that was going out to Malsus Aurelius.
All right, now you've completely lost me.
I have no idea what it is.
We have a pet hamster at the house.
Oh.
This is the second pet hamster. The first one was named Testicles. This one is named Malsus Aurelius. There's a Latin thing.
Oh, I know.
Thing.
And Testicles
is a Greek thing.
He was a great philosopher, Malsus Aurelius.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. So what, Greek or Roman? Greek philosopher?
No, he was the last philosopher king, so to speak, of Rome.
So
Marcus Aurelius.
Now that we've started with the shout-outs, I have one more shout-out before we continue, and that's to the three, count them, three Georgia Tech alums that are currently on the orbiting space shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
Which one is it, by the way? I mean, I just looked it up. It's ST-136 or something.
Endeavor?
Is it Endeavor? I think it's Endeavor.
Yeah, Endeavor. Yeah.
Right. So actually, a friend of mine who I used to see over in the Bunker Hunter building all the time, Sandra Magnus. So Sandy did her PhD in material science and engineering here at Georgia Tech in 1996. And then I was looking through the roster, and actually Eric Bowe, who's a colonel in the United States Air Force, went to the Air Force Academy but came back, got his degree in 1997 in electrical engineering at Georgia Tech. Did you know an Eric Bowe, BOE?
No, I did not.
And then I forgot the second. Oh, I printed out two of the same page. There's actually a third guy whose name I do not
Mike
have here.
Mike Finke, maybe?
Is it Finke? Could be.
Oh, there's a Mike Finke on there. He's the commander.
Well, at least three out of the seven.
When he gets back to Georgia Earth, Tech. He's going to change his last name.
All right, we've obviously shortchanged whoever the third guy is. But MIT only has two. We have three. So there you have
same,
it.
On the same mission?
Go Jackets.
All right.
Go Jackets.
Yeah.
All right. All right, now, before we begin, ladies and gentlemen, I believe our guest has a rant. A rant is the only way to describe it. But it's an illustration of what we talked about last week when we talked with Charlie Bennett about, you know, revenue models for journals and libraries and electronic things. Does everything have to have a revenue model? Apparently, driving in the state of Georgia does.
Yes. I woke this morning, went downstairs, poured the water, tying to the theme of the show, into the coffee pot, grabbed the AJC, and was struck by Sonny Perdue's new venture into taxing the poor man, the middle
class.
The faculty here at Georgia
the
Tech.
The Republicans don't raise taxes, though, so I don't know what you're talking about.
So if you're reaching for your AJC as this program is airing, you'll see the cover or the headline article about funding Lexus lanes in I-85 from the perimeter into Gwinnett.
So you have to drive a Lexus to drive in these things?
I wish it were so. One of the real joys of living in Gwinnett and coming to Georgia Tech each morning is the presence of the high-occupancy vehicle lane, which my wife and I both work here, so we can drive down and get to Tech within 45 minutes.
Also reducing the amount of greenhouse gases and gas consumption.
Yes.
A good thing.
He's an environmentally sound sculptor, chemist guy.
Yeah. But if Purdue's plan goes into effect, that lane will become a toll lane, and carpools will be defined as more than three people, not more than two. And there'll be a per mile charge for any vehicle in this HOT lane.
So you'll have to have four people in there. So basically, only illegal aliens can drive.
Your construction crews. Yes.
Oh God.
What? Come on, have you ever seen four white people in a car? Honestly, answer me that question.
Yes. Yeah. People like me that commute in.
My family works.
There you go. What? But I mean, so, all right, so you're just mad because you're taking away your HOV line.
Yeah, and he's going to put in, well, the federales are going to fund the technology required to do this. There won't be any toll booths in the lane. It'll be the overhead sensors, which will trigger.
With an RFID.
Yes. But I mean, I guess you can tell us more about how those things work, Bill.
Sure.
But this is, okay, I know what you're wondering. Is he just ranting because he's going to lose his HOV lane?
Okay, yes, he is.
Possibly. But let's bring this back to science and technology. And this is a reoccurring theme we've talked about many, many times before, that science and technology doesn't care about what business people care about, which is the revenue model or the business model. And the next generation of journals, as we mentioned last week, might not have a regular revenue model. And science and doing the right thing environmentally doesn't always happen to have a revenue model, but it seems as though the only way we ever get anything done in this country is with a revenue model. If someone can't make money off of it, it's not going to happen. Am I just being cynical here or what?
Well, you are being cynical, but you're also being truthful. I mean, you know, if you don't have, you know, if you've got something, well, you know, you see with people contributing to charities, if they don't get it deducted on their income tax, they're less likely to give.
Okay, just but, you know, example. I think that's so, just the government meeting you halfway. I think that's
no, but I mean, you know, if you didn't have that, they're all worried if you got rid of that deduction that have fewer people.
But when will our motivation be to reduce greenhouse gases, to reduce oil consumption, just because we realize in the future it's going to be a really important thing, not because we have to pay
right
for it?
Right before you
will
die.
All right, Larry, will that ever happen?
I don't think so. Okay. Case in point is the Volt, that new automobile that GM is going to make.
The electric car.
And the suggested retail price is going to be $40,000. Wait a minute. I can buy a PT Cruiser for just over $13,000. Same level of creature comfort. And that gives me $27,000 difference to pay for the gasoline I'll use to drive the PT Cruiser.
Right, well, exactly. And other, like my Sebring convertible, if I go 55 miles an hour, I get 43 miles per gallon.
Hmm. Do you really?
Yeah.
In Atlanta?
Control.
No way.
No, yeah. Well, I mean, if you're on the road.
He's not stopping.
On the road thing. But no, I don't get 43 miles per gallon going to work.
But you only
back.
Get that because of the low-friction hair gel in your hair.
Yeah, I switched to low-friction hair gel, thank you for noticing, some months back. It's kind of creepy that you actually noticed that.
But I'm more surprised at where you could drive in Atlanta at 55 miles an hour and not be a hazard to other motorists, especially not between Macon or Atlanta.
No, but Sunday, on the road. But, yeah, I mean, it's a very – I guess my point is it's very efficient, and so I'm not sure – would I be getting 80 miles per gallon driving over to Birmingham or something like that if I – you know, if I had a better car?
I'm going to go with a no on that.
Okay, yeah, that would be my guess.
All right, it's probably time we make a segue into the actual topic. Mm-hmm. And today's topic, regardless of what I called it on the title, is analytical chemistry.
You aren't going to talk about your sports thing?
No, I don't know if we're going to have time for that. We may use that later.
Oh, it's perfect. Right. Okay.
We need to save that for another science.
Well,
you know,
you could talk about football on Saturday and rumors that the dogs.
To talk about.
Okay.
Analytical chemistry. Okay,
we
so
okay.
For those of you who watch CSI, let me ask Larry, what exactly is analytical chemistry?
Succinctly, it's a chemist, or an analytical chemist is someone who can take a sample, figure out what's in it, and how much of that substance is there, but probably isn't able to tell you how it got there or what to do with it once you know what it is.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. I mean, and what you want to know is, are there toxins, poisons, things, for example, in your water?
Right. So water's a chemical. Like it or not.
Well, despite the fact they put chemical-free all over products, everything's a chemical. If it has molecules, it's a chemical, right?
Right.
Okay, so what are the things that typically are most interested in knowing at what concentration it is in water?
Well, first, we want to know if there's any toxins in the water that we're drinking. We'd like to know if there are any salts in the water that we're drinking. We'd like to know if there are any parasites in the water that we're drinking.
Because
all three could cause problems.
Okay.
Right.
So now you're more analytical chemistry, not bio. How do you look for parasites? Do you know how to look for parasites in water? I mean,
the simplest way is to put a droplet of water on a microscope slide and look at it under a light microscope.
All right, I like simple. Simple's good.
And if you put a little dye, a little organic chemical mm-hmm. that has color that will preferentially stick to the parasite, right. then it's very, very easy to visualize.
Right, and we even have dyes that will not only look at, you know, multi-celled organisms, but even single-celled organisms,
yes.
right? So, but when people treat water, they're much less likely to, you know, look at this concentration than they are is just to use a brute force sort of napalm approach to killing it all.
Right.
And in Cobb County, you can't help but notice this. It's Cobb County where I live, chlorine. Mm-hmm. So chlorine gas is what they put in there.
Yes, right? Hypochlorite.
Okay.
Same chemicals you can put in your swimming pool to knock out the parasites and adjust it.
No, but how do they actually put it in it as like a sodium hypochlorite salt, like chlorine?
Or bubble seal, Cl2, 3, yes.
Okay, because the two, they'll interconvert,
yes.
right? Okay. So, but I was under the impression that they like the gaseous chlorine because any extra that was in there at least would come out.
And kill people.
Yes.
No, I mean, a little bit of chlorine is...
But our environmental engineers and our water quality experts have that down to
right, tuned science. To exactly what that is.
I mean,
right.
there's very precise mm-hmm. control on the amount of material that's put in uh-huh. So that you want to put exactly as much of this oxidant in as you need, plus a sconch more, but not too much more. So it's deleterious.
Sconch, that would be the technical term
yes.
for that?
It's a SI unit.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but what about simple things? I mean, most people don't realize when they think of water, it's not 100% water. There's a little bit of hydroxide ion and a little bit of, hydrogen ion.
There's other kind of ions in there as well, right?
I mean, well,
you've got to deionize the water for it to not be conductive. So.
Well, yeah, if it's...
Well, even ultra-pure water has some mm-hmm. low concentration of ions in it. And mm-hmm. the ions that Pete mentioned are the two that are there. It's caused from water itself... undergoing an exchange process so that one water molecule loses a hydrogen atom and or hydrogen ion and gives it to a neighbor, and what's left behind is a hydroxide ion. And mm-hmm. if you do the count in mm-hmm. ultra-pure water, the total number of ions you're going to find there is 1/10 millionth
right.
of the sample.
10 to the minus 7th. So when it's completely neutral, pure water, the concentration of the hydroxide or the hydrogen atom, well, they're equal when it's right. completely neutral, is 10 to the minus 7th. And basically, if you take the log of that, that's the number that 10 is taken to that power, take the negative of it, that's what pH is. So completely neutral water is pH 7. That means it's got 10 to the minus 7th concentration of this acid proton. And, I mean, ions, just so everybody knows what we're talking about, are... Water is two hydrogen atoms and an oxygen atom. One hydrogen atom splits off, leaves its electron behind, so it's an H plus. Then the oxygen hydrogen hydroxyl OH minus is there. If you want to increase these, right, you throw in a compound that releases lots of hydroxyls. So this would make it very basic. Good example, sodium hydroxide,
yes.
potassium hydroxide.
Yes.
Right?
But are there other ions in the water as well?
Oh, yeah. So
sodium,
salts.
Chlorine, yeah. all salts in there?
Yeah.
In potable water, yes. In seawater, yes.
Okay, so potable water,
but
drinkable
ultra-pure
water,
no. It's right. just H2O.
But, you know, the stuff coming out of the tap has
oh,
ions.
Yeah. Small
right?
amounts of just salts.
Sodium.
You don't want a
salt.
Lot, though, right? Because you don't want to drink
no,
salt
two,
water.
There's two reasons for it. One would be the cost of purifying it to that mm-hmm. point. And second, the taste of ultra-pure water isn't very satisfying.
Right. I mean, so mineral water has exactly that, real small concentrations mm-hmm. of some kinds of salts.
Right.
And the balance of which make it taste good. The important thing, though, is that that water is, let me see if I get the right term from the bio people, hypotonic. It has less concentration of salts than you do in general in your body.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Seawater is hypertonic, meaning more. So you can't consume seawater because you have no water to flush out the salts in your system. It has to be lower in concentration.
So let me ask you guys this. So there's been, desalinization
right.
plants. So how is that working? Is it cost effective? Is that what they do in Dubai for water?
That's exactly what they do in Dubai.
Okay.
All right, so Larry can talk about maybe the two ways or so they typically do that.
So if I want to recover water from Lake Lanier or Chattahoochee mm-hmm. and I want to convert it into ultra-pure water, I can undergo a distillation. I can take it through distillation.
Which means you...
So we boil the water, we convert it from the liquid form to the steam, and we condense the steam into a separate receiver.
Right.
We
do this multiple times. Over and over again. And nobody
and when you're doing
does
that,
it...
You're doing it at a temperature volatility that the salts don't come out in the steam?
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. And even if the thing you're separating is a liquid, you find the thing that's more volatile keeps coming out. So if you're a moonshiner... Mm-hmm. Not that I'm suggesting
why,
this.
Why are you
a,
accusing me of that again?
No, I'm not saying you.
Every couple of weeks,
if
I'm
one
from Mississippi,
is a
you accuse me of being a moonshiner.
You boil your mixture of basically water and alcohol.
Nothing for you for Thanksgiving.
The alcohol, more alcohol comes out each time you boil it. So what you do is you boil it, condense it. And you don't actually have separate pots. You boil it in a big column that has little sort of trays to allow it to recondense on. That's called fractional distillation. And that's how you get it separated. No, but the problem with this is that the energy to boil water is very, very high.
Yes. Right. So the cost of purifying water for a large population like the metro Atlanta by distillation would be
horrible.
Astronomical.
Yeah.
So, plan B, or an alternative way to do it, would be through ion exchange, which is the basis for many of the water purifiers that we can buy and put on our taps in the kitchen. And the strategy here is we'll have two types of filters that the water will pass through. The first is typically activated charcoal, which will absorb any of the organics that might be present in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And the second stage will be ion exchange resin, in which we're selectively removing cations and anions.
Right.
The products
so
of
positive,
cations,
positive
and negative. Anions negative. Right.
Right.
So,
but what about for seawater? So what's the desalinization?
Well, in Dubai, because the concentration's higher, they don't do ion exchange. Ion exchange is when you really want to take out those last few sets of ions. They do what's called reverse osmosis. And osmosis is a real simple process. In principle, all these things are simple processes. I just wish we taught them that way. You have a membrane, right? And it's a pretty impressive membrane that
so a membrane would
has
be
holes that are
what?
So small that it will let water go through, but not the thing you're trying to separate.
So what kind of material might they be made
of? Sausage casing.
Usually polymers, right.
Okay.
And a sausage casing, if it comes from a natural intestine, is a lot of polymeric things, proteins.
How about from
like
an unnatural intestine?
Well, it would be, you know, some other synthetic polymer.
Yeah.
DuPont sells several. Teflon Tefcells 1.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Polyesters, polyamides.
So the water goes through, but the salts don't?
Right. So what happens is if you take salt water on one side and put pure water on the other, Nafion, which is a sulfonic acid fluorinated polymer.
Right.
Yeah. So also used in fuel cells, right, as the proton exchange membrane. We could do a whole show on Nafion. Fascinating polymer.
So how cost effective is this?
Well, it's much
so
more cost effective. I mean, so say you have two sides of a vessel, one with pure water, one with salt water. What happens is the water rises higher on the pure water side, and that, you know why? Because, rises higher on the salt water side, because the water wants to get in there and naturally dilute those salts. That pressure difference is called the osmotic pressure. And what you do to get the pure water out is put that much additional pressure, you put an overpressure on the side with the salts, and it literally squishes the water right out. So that's how reverse osmosis works. That's much more cost effective because water is one of the hardest things to boil that we know of because it's got all these little, do I invoke the term hydrogen bonds?
Sure.
It's got a lot of hydrogen bonds.
I think you
water
just
likes
did.
To stick together, right?
Yeah.
So water is the same molecular weight as, you know, low molecular weight hydrocarbons. Those are gases at room temperature. Water is a liquid. So, boiling water is very, very expensive.
So how cost effective is it?
Well, that's where most of the Middle East gets their drinking water. When I go to Dubai, near my hotel where I stayed last, they're building a new substation for drinking water purification using reverse osmosis. And everyone complains about the tap water over there. I don't think it's that bad.
So, is it outrageously expensive to do this, or they don't care because they got all the money
in the
world?
Well, let's put it this way. What's the alternative? Building a giant canal from Europe? Yeah, I think it's cost
effective. Been there, done that.
Yeah. Right? So
aqueducts.
Yeah, so for them, it works out reasonably well. And it's only getting cheaper as we improve these materials and the processes by which we do it.
So with all this problems we've been having in Georgia over the last few years that's caused the governor to, you know, have a prayer.
Somebody actually did talk about desalination plants in Georgia.
So, would it be cost-effective here if you had a
I don't think it's cost-effective yet. Okay. But yeah, I mean, in theory, if Lake Lanier dried up, that might be something we need to think about.
What do you mean, if?
It boils down to choices, right?
Right, it's all about choices. Mm-hmm. We'll probably do a show on this later, but in 2 years, we're going to have a bigger problem just with electric power here in the state of Georgia than we are with water. I'm going to save that for another show. Yeah, right. We've got some shortages looming on the horizon.
Really?
And who's the local politician that's trying to acquire some land between Georgia and into Tennessee so we can tap into the Tennessee Valley Authority water supply?
Are you talking about the governor?
Yes.
Okay. You're just mad about your lanes. Yes. There it is.
I'm steamed.
He's steamed. All right, so say, for example, we're going to analyze what's in things. So what are the kinds of techniques we would do to do that?
Analyzing water? Well, yeah. I have in front of me here the standard methods for the examination of water and wastewater, 20th edition, 1998.
First of all,
the Bible.
All right, wait. He's frightening me, so we should probably take a break before he opens up this giant 9,000-page book. We'll be right back talking about what's in the water with our guest, Professor Larry Bottomley from the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry, here on Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
This is Friction. Friction Wednesdays, 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Hi, this is Victoria Robertson with a reminder for 18-year-old men. If you want to be a guy who's going places, first you have to take a step in the right direction. Remember to register with Selective Service. By registering, you'll get a great start towards an even better future because it keeps you eligible for student loans, job training, and government jobs. Registration is easy and fast, so do something important for your country. Register at any post office or online at sss.gov.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta. And just a reminder, if you got a question or comment about analytical chemistry and analyzing stuff in water, please give us a call at 404-894-2468. So now we're back to our guest, Larry Bottomley, who is going to talk about analyzing stuff in water. What do we want to analyze?
Okay.
Anyone have a thought?
It depends on what the use of the water is going to be. If you're into earthships and building environmentally friendly homes, then the concept of white water, gray water, and black water is very familiar to people. White water is potable water, water you're willing to drink, consume in large quantities, cook with, etc. Gray water is water that is not so pure that you can use for specific purposes, like washing clothes, etc.
Okay, so like gray water is what I collect in my shower now that we've got a drought and we water the plants with it. It's got a little soap, and of course it's got whatever grease came off of me that day.
Right.
And, okay, so that's gray water?
That's gray water, and it can be used for a variety of purposes within a home.
A horrible thought for the listening audience.
Yes. And then there's black water.
My wife and I do that. We're in a drought here. You know?
In a shower collecting the ooze.
Well, you could be in the bathroom collecting ooze, but we'll
Is that considered black water?
That's black water.
Okay.
Okay, so that has to be processed or held in a separate tank and removed from possible consumption.
Okay, so this is basically toilet water.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so what you're going to analyze for the water depends on what the use is going to be.
Okay.
Why don't we just start with the source of the water?
Okay.
Where do we get water that we drink? Well, we could go down to the store and buy distilled water. As I mentioned before, right. It's not very tasty. We can get water from the tap, in which we're relying on the City of Atlanta Water Works personnel to provide us potable water. And they do. They do a remarkably good job. this water comes.
Well, finally, you said something good about somebody. Yeah. I thought it was just bitter and angry.
Remarkably good job. I mean, the water quality in Atlanta is some of the best.
He is bitter and angry, but he's more than that.
Well, I drink the tap water here, so
I do too.
I have no complaints.
Yeah.
And it tastes better than the water in Jacksonville and Los Angeles. So
okay, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Atlanta, the water capital
better than
of
LA.
The world.
Yeah.
So, where does the water come from that Atlanta uses to distribute? Well, it comes from wells, it comes from rivers, and it comes from reservoirs.
Now, hold on the well water. Where do we have wells dug for the municipal water supply?
Actually, some cities in the suburban areas do actually have wells.
Really?
So
yeah.
People have private wells as well.
Mm-hmm. Why not? Yeah, we have
wells as well.
Private well in Canada at our place up there.
Oh, okay.
And it's great water.
Okay. And I don't have the facts and figures in front of me, but the city of Atlanta recycles a great deal of their water.
Okay, and in California, they were looking at recycling even black water.
Right.
Right, and as disgusting as it sounds, that's actually what they're doing at the International Space Station as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And let's face it, we've all had a little introduction to that anyway, right? Because this is why when you're on the airline, the water is blue. It is recycled to some degree. Right.
No, the blue is a chemical that's added to the water to keep the odor down and to keep the level of parasites down.
Oh, okay. But isn't it because they're worried about recycling some of that?
That too.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't want stuff that has had bacteria in it or something like that and a slight yellow tint would freak people out. Okay. Now, granted, you're not drinking that, so that's not...
I'm not. You may be.
So far, I have not done that on a Delta 777 in any trips recently, but...
I'll have some scotch and black water, please.
I guess it's blue water.
Yeah.
All right, so let's pick something that we're going to...
Okay, first we can analyze for acidity. Very simple measurement. You can go down to your local hardware store and buy litmus, or you can buy...
A pH meter?
A pH meter.
Right, which is an ion selective electrode, right?
Yes. And make a measurement of the concentration of hydronium ion and the concentration of hydroxide ion that's present in the water.
And that works well on white water, maybe gray water. But when there's lots of junk in it, those measurements can get interfered with, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And this is what makes analytical chemistry hard, by the way. It's not as simple as just reading it off of...
So we're starting the discussion here from simple mixtures or pure chemicals and moving to very complex systems.
Right.
Like the water that's coming out of the Howell Mill... water recycling plant.
Right.
The water going into there is going to be a very complex mixture. Making the measurement of what's in it and how much of that substance is there can be very, very challenging. So an analytical chemist has an arsenal of techniques and methods that they can use to analyze for specific things. In general, the selection of the method depends upon three things. What you want to measure and what else is in the sample,
mm-hmm.
How accurate the measurement has to be.
Right.
And what the range is that you expect to find. By range, I'm referring to the concentration range.
Right. So if it's really, really small, we like to use sensitive techniques like fluorescence spectroscopy versus other things.
Right. Okay. Or if it's present in a large, high concentration, then we can get by with electrode measurements, colorimetric assays.
Right.
You know, very, very straightforward techniques to apply. Things get dicey, however, when the analytical technique is sensitive to multiple components present in that sample,
mm-hmm.
right? So that we'll have a chemical that we want to measure, and there's other chemicals that our technique will measure as well and be unable to distinguish between what we want to measure and the other components. We call those interferences then.
Right.
So then we have to have separation schemes. We have to have a way to remove either the interference that are present in the sample or remove the analyte of interest in a very reliable way so we can make the measurement on that material. So that brings up a host of separation techniques. On a large scale, separation techniques are distillation, there's sedimentation or precipitation, you can do extraction.
Right, where you mix it with another solvent that it wants to go into, it pulls it out.
So, the at-home example of an extraction is the salad dressing that one has when you make it with vinegar, water, and a little olive oil with spices added. Mm-hmm. You've got two phases. The olive oil doesn't mix with the water layer, but the spices will distribute between the two.
Oh, okay. There you go. And when you do this extraction, I mean, the classic thing is this funny sort of bulb-shaped separatory funnel, right? It's got a little stopcock on the bottom. Everybody sees it on cartoons of labs, but that's what it's used for.
Right, and that's in the chemistry lab, but over in your neck of the woods in chemical engineering, it's done in a completely different scale.
Yeah, we use this giant liquid-liquid exchange column, so.
Right.
Yeah. So then chromatography is an example of one of these separation techniques.
Right.
Okay.
And the concept of chromatography is the same as extraction. You're going to move the material interest from one phase into the other. In extraction, you have an organic phase and an aqueous phase.
Organic and aqueous means organic oil, aqueous water. That's probably the best way to do it. All these organic compounds that don't like water go in the oil phase.
Right. And some chemicals have a preference for both, and then that keeps people like me in business.
Yeah, and for those of you that think you've never seen an example of chromatography, if you remember the movie My Cousin Vinny, where the guy in the stand said he analyzed the content of the rubber tire with a Hewlett-Packard dual injection gas chromatograph with flame ionization detector, that's gas chromatograph. That's a common way to separate organic compounds from water, things like that, right?
Right, and then so that conceptually, that instrument is a tube, and the tube has a coating on the walls of the tube, and your sample is pushed through it. So in gas chromatography, the sample that you're pushing through, that is in the gaseous phase. Liquid chromatography, the sample you're pushing through is in the liquid phase.
And oftentimes you inject a liquid, but it boils and then recondenses on that sidewall, and then it gets separated. Mm-hmm. And what's neat is you see the detector giving you these little peaks that tell you how much of what's in there. But what's nice is it also separates it. So what people often do is they'll put a moth at the exit port to this, and if they want to figure out what are the pheromones out of something, when the moth starts flapping its wings, when that peak comes out, boom, that's the one that gets it excited. So fortunately, they're usually grinding up other moths, turning it into a liquid to inject, which is not very good. But
I'm not going to touch the whole moth thing. But, one kind of engineering aspect for people is, so they obviously don't test every single milliliter of water coming out. They spot test, right?
Right. And that's part of the wonderful properties of liquids and specifically of water, in that if you have good mixing, the composition of the sample that you test is identical to the composition
that touches
of the whole.
Yeah.
Right? The other part about this separation and detection issue is range, dosage range. The analytical techniques all function very, very well over a defined concentration range. For example, you might have an analytical method that would function well between 1% weight to volume up to 10%. And so if you present to that sample a solution that's 50% the substance that you want to analyze, you'll get an erroneous reading unless you dilute that sample into the effective range of the sensor. Others are very, very good at very small quantities, part per billion, part per million level.
Right.
So it's right. One
part
molecule in 10 to the sixth.
30 years ago, part per billion was really hard to get for a lot of things. That's more of a recent phenomenon, right?
Yes.
To get parts per billion.
Right. Well, you can even look at the dawn of the semiconductor age and the level of concentration of impurities in the silicon was in that parts per billion range, and so people hadn't been worried about those levels in an industrial setting before, of introducing an impurity into silicon at such a low level and control it. So the technology for all that had to come along. Actually, the first patent for a field effect transistor was in 1928. But they just didn't have the technology for the chemical purity and all that.
And it depends what the impurity is. If the impurity is a metal, that's really bad for the semiconductor,
Right. Well, a lot of things are bad. But, anyway, it's just getting down to that really fine level.
You were asking before about, salts in the water. Mm-hmm. So that's relevant to most people, especially if you live in an area with hard water. So what's hard water and how do you fix that?
Hard water has a high concentration of phosphate or sulfate ion and typically calcium and other cations as well. So it's a high salt content, but specific salts of interest are the ones that will deposit in the bathtub
and
ring.
Calcium salts do that.
And how does it affect soap? It has some effect on soaps. Is that part of it too, or no?
Well, the calcium in the water will precipitate with the phosphonic
acid.
So
phosphate detergent.
Right. So
So it makes it harder to get soap in and get it frothing and get it to work, right? You have to have a fair amount of soap in there.
Right.
So
okay.
Things don't lather as much. They precipitate in your bathtub. I mean, this is how you get kidney stones, right? These are calcium salts that precipitate as well. So,
right.
So how does a water softener work then?
Water softener is the a filtration step in which ions are removed from the water. They're removed by passing it through a bed of particles. And the particles are porous, and on the walls of the pores, there is either cationic or anionic sites.
Okay.
So if you want to remove cations from the water, like calcium, then you would percolate the water through resin that has sulfonic acid groups, SO3 minus groups on the
So it's ion exchange.
So it's ion exchange. Okay. The calcium will stick, and hydrogen ion will be released into the water.
Okay, so ion exchange. But why do we have to put salt in a water softener? I'm talking about the one in your home, not necessarily more of an analytical technique. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, and that's have the concentration of the precipitatable
ion. Oh, it balances things. So does that mean it puts sodium chloride in there instead of the calcium salt?
And removes the calcium.
Okay, so a little bit of sodium chloride, you know, table salt, is okay when it comes to this. You're getting rid of a particular salt that makes everything precipitate out and wrecks
you. Yes, or the particular cation that leads to a salt that will not be soluble in water and will stay in that salt bed.
So are folks like you in analytical chemistry seeing a big upturn in people applying for this program now that we have CSI?
There's a big interest in forensic science, forensic chemistry. But there
which
are very
is sort
few
of
programs.
The application of analytical chemistry one of the to crime.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
The problem is that there are only a few certified programs in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Where students can go get a degree in forensic chemistry or forensic science and actually have the training they need to move directly into these law enforcement positions.
Wow. But don't they hire a lot of regular analytical chemists?
They do, and then they have to go through retraining.
Okay.
Right.
Ah, I see.
So some of my former students are now working at the at GBI or the State Crime Lab, and they had to go through extensive retraining because in that particular application of analytical chemistry, it's not only the quality of the measurements you make and the validation of the procedure you're using to make that measurement, it's also the legal interpretation of the findings that you have.
Ah, I see.
Control of a sample that you wouldn't have to worry about,
right.
I presume.
So good laboratory practice. So the laboratory itself has to be certified. The person doing the analysis has to be certified, and the analytical method they're using and techniques that they're using have to be certified.
Well, and what's considered good laboratory practice for the GBI is not the same as good laboratory practice, say, at the waterworks.
Exactly.
So the different end goals, you've got to have a chain of command of what happened to the sample and all this other kind of stuff, and you don't necessarily worry
about
that.
So are you guys getting any peripheral advantage here? Are people at least getting interested in chemistry because of this?
There's a bump in our enrollment. In fact, this year, typically we bring in 30 to 35 freshmen. Mm-hmm. This year we brought in 60.
It's
a bump.
That's impressive.
Because of two things. One is the interest in forensic chemistry, and the second is the advent of our Bachelor of Science program in biochemistry.
Ah, okay.
So,
big plus.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how accurate is CSI? Have you watched CSI?
Quite a bit. The consultants that they have on the program do an excellent job. The point of reference for the graybeards that might be listening to the show, you'll have the show Quincy.
I remember Quincy.
Jack Klugman.
As a forensic pathologist.
Yeah, and the problem with Quincy is that he would draw conclusions based on analytical measurements that couldn't do what he claimed they would do. The one I remember most vividly was the accusation of a certain person committing murder because he found snake venom on the steering wheel of that individual's automobile. And he proved it was snake venom using an atomic absorption spectrometer, which is only good for metals.
Right, because you might want to explain how it works.
Okay, an atomic absorption spectrometer, you place a sample into it. It's usually a liquid form of the sample. It gets aspirated into an aerosol and sprayed into a flame.
A real high-temperature flame.
Yes, and the flame causes the desolvation, so you evaporate the water. The salts that are left in the dried particle then absorb energy from the flame. They dissociate, they vaporize, and then they absorb light of characteristic wavelengths. So the other part of the atomic absorption spectrometer is a beam of light specific for the metal ion that you're trying to analyze. It passes through the flame, and then you measure the reduction in intensity of that particular wavelength and correlate that to concentration.
So you wouldn't take an organic like hydrocortisone and do that. You could tell how much magnesium is in something, how much, you know, manganese, iron, things like that.
But you could not tell an organic molecule.
Right. So if you so if you're trying this, well, you don't want to try this at home, but if you take a metal salt and you just put it in a very high temperature flame, mm-hmm. you can get different colors.
Yes.
And sometimes you get different colors in the visible range, and that's what fireworks manufacturers take advantage of.
Right.
You mix your different metals differently, and magnesium's is white hot. That's a horribly bright thing. But you can get reds and blues and all sorts of stuff.
Yes,
and
greens, et cetera.
Right,
that's what the Duralog business is based on as well.
So, oh, really? Yeah. They put some metals in there? Give you a little red and green in there? Wow. I feel so used. I thought it was just, you know, the natural romantic warmness of the flame. And you're saying it's all manufactured.
Yes.
Wow.
So for folks at home worried about the complexity of the water they're drinking, they have three choices. Trust the Atlanta Waterworks and drink freely. Put in some filtration system that you can buy at the local hardware store.
Mm-hmm.
Or hire someone to carry out an in-depth analysis for you. And the problem with the latter approach is you have to have a good idea of what you want to analyze for and why it's worth mm-hmm. analyzing for it. If you're depending on water coming from your own personal well, then paying for that analysis is probably a good thing at first because it gives you a good idea of what toxic
right.
metals may be present in your water.
Mm-hmm.
If the results come back positive, say for arsenic, should you worry? Well, it depends, and it depends on the concentration of arsenic that's present in the water. If the concentration is very, very low, and you plan on living 60 or 70 years in this location, you might consider having an arsenic removal system in place. Now, by very, very low, I'm talking down at the lowest levels that the analytical method can detect.
So things like
parts per trillion.
Billion and trillion, okay.
Yes.
Wow.
Right.
Arsenic's kind of all around rocks and soil. Is that common to find arsenic?
It's common to find arsenic depending upon the source of the well
mm-hmm.
and the geographical location. The folks in Bangladesh, arsenic in the water supply is a very serious problem. And the World Health Organization has put out a call and found solutions that are practical in Bangladesh.
Oh, okay.
In certain regions in the U.S., we have a similar problem, but the EPA is on those, and the water supplies coming from those sources are appropriately decontaminated.
So would arsenic be absorbed at all by activated charcoal, or is that mainly just organics?
Ion exchange.
Ion exchange, okay, because it's a metal, right?
Right. It's arsenic 3 and arsenic 5 both come off. Both are readily absorbed in ion exchange resins, and those are expensive for the folks in Bangladesh, but they're reasonable for folks in the U.S.
Okay.
Let me ask you this for, the EPA regulations on concentrations of certain chemicals in the water.
Mm-hmm.
My impression, just from talking to people and not anything with a good scientific foundation, is that we've over-specified how little of certain contaminants can be in there.
Meaning they're too strict on the tolerances?
Too stringent.
Yeah.
And
many
so that's
people
part of why
that.
You start to see industry leaving the U.S. in the 60s is just impossible to do it here, so you move it someplace else. You haven't really fixed the problem for Mother Earth. You've just moved it out of your neighborhood.
Well, which side do you want to err on? Do you want to err on the side of, oops, we didn't know it was toxic, and look at how many people are dying now because of this, or, oops, we didn't really need to be that cautious?
Are these people that we really want around us, or are we going to be just okay without them?
Depends on your neighborhood.
All right, so if it's your neighborhood in Decatur,
oh, hell no.
Then
just
like,
got to be
okay.
Very careful there.
So
my children, your children, not so much. But
the other aspect of this is as technological improvements are made, then the concentration range for specific substances that we can analyze for drops. So 20 years ago, when our analytical methods were only good at down to a part per million level, then the regulatory agencies set the levels at that value or near that value. With improvements in the analytical methodology, we can get down to a part per trillion, and as a result, the
And at least in the chemical industry where I work, the EPA is continuously pushing those limits to sort of match what the detectability.
But are they reasonable? I know they want to err on the side of us being, but you know,
that's not an easy question to answer. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I don't think it's as clear cut as some of those articles would suggest.
And some of the things that are now gaining airplay that the media is picking up on. It's really unknown whether deleterious or beneficial. An example might be the recycled water in the metropolitan New York City area.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can find digitalis in that water. You can find Viagra.
Right, what is digitalis?
Heart.
Oh, heart medication. So then sildenafil nitrate, Viagra, these sorts of things.
Yes, I mean, there's trace quantities.
Estrogen.
Of these compounds in the drinking water. Is it bad news?
Right, if they're that small.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. But so, for example, you mentioned these home filtration things. One of the most common ones to use is literally a cartridge filter with activated charcoal.
Right.
And a lot of people don't really know what activated charcoal is. Now, I'm oversimplifying it. To make good activated charcoal is not a trivial process, but it really is sort of like carbonized charcoal. But it's made in such a way that its surface area is so huge that one little spoonful of this literally has a square meter or something like that of surface area. And if you get enough surface area, and it's sort of a carbon organic sort of thing, it will absorb most organics if you give it enough surface area, and it filters a lot of stuff out, even though it's really just kind of charcoal made in a special way.
Very effective.
Yeah.
Very effective at removing organics from water until you saturated all of the area, the surface area,
and then
with adsorbates.
Yeah.
And then the reverse process works.
Then it comes off.
So if your filter in your refrigerator that goes from the tap over to your ice maker says it's good for 6 months, and you've got it in there for a year and a half,
you're
concentrating your ice cubes with organic.
And now when the reasonably pure water comes through, it will pull that off. So this is the concept of equilibrium.
So, right? In Bill's case, it will definitely enhance the flavor of the cheap scotch he's drinking.
There you go. Wow. All right. That's good to know. And in fact, the problem is you don't see this in your sink filter and in your refrigerator filter. Where you see it is in your aquarium. Because in your aquarium, there's so much junk coming out of an aquarium that you will literally, the filter that
it'll
holds
clog up quickly.
Will clog up with literally solids. And then okay, I better change this. But you won't see this in drinking water because you're filtering out microscopic molecules that, you can't tell. It doesn't clog the filter or anything like that.
Yeah, but
will it filter out birth control medicine and Viagra and all that?
Those are organics.
Yes.
Yeah.
It will. Okay.
So,
provided
does it completely remove it?
No.
Mm-hmm. That's an open question because we don't have the analytical technique that will
tell how far,
tell
down,
how
is,
far
yeah.
down it is. Mm-hmm. Will it reduce the concentration? Yes, no question.
Okay.
All right, so we've come to that time of the program where we try to assess, where try is the operative word here, ladies and gentlemen. What have we learned? So, Bill, what have we learned today?
Well, I'm going to keep drinking the city water. I'm going to do that.
I like my city water.
Yeah, and... it's kind of nice to know that the carbon filters are, cutting out some of these endocrine molecules, signaling molecules.
And I guess the key is that analytical chemistry is important, even if it's not applied to CSI.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm going to go with that one.
That works for me.
And then there are a lot of different techniques, and the key, and this is what a good analytical chemist does, is match the technique with the level and the particular thing you're trying to get, right? So we learned from Quincy. We will henceforth refer to this as the Quincy debacle.
Mm-hmm.
Atomic absorption, atomic emission spectroscopy. Look at metals, right? Organics, you would use, there's all sorts of techniques that you could
mass
use
spectrometry.
Right. That measures the
red spectroscopy.
Right. That measures the vibrational frequency of the bonds in that thing.
Yes.
You can use NMR on that as well.
Right.
That measures the different types of atoms that are in there, right?
But the best tool to use is mass spectrometry.
Right, because it clearly gives you the molecular weight of the molecule. And it can also give it to you of the various fragments in there, so you can piece it together.
And so very complex mixtures, you can carry out both the separation of the components of that mixture and the identification of the components of the mixture all in one assay.
Right.
Unfortunately, most of the audience is not going to run out and buy a mass spectrometer because the cost of them ranges from about $50,000 up to $1 million a pop.
Right.
So, you know, it's not something that you could put in your house.
But I guess the final important thing to learn is that, you know, when you take analytical chemistry in college and you look at these simple expressions for concentration times the amount of transmission or something of a particular wavelength of light, that can get interfered with when you have complex mixtures. So if you start with a complex mixture, you need to do some kind of separation. And, you know, there, you can distill, you can use gas chromatography like we talked about from My Cousin Vinny, things like that. So it's you often will apply more than one technique to this sort of thing. All right.
You have to. To get an accurate measure of the components of a mixture requires the use of several techniques. It also requires some decisions about, okay, what's most important? Should I analyze only the toxic substances?
Right.
Should I analyze for only the substances in high concentration?
Yeah. And we don't always know whether parts per billion or parts per trillion really have a bad effect on people.
Right. And then the last point is just because a substance is present in the water doesn't mean it's necessarily toxic to you.
Right.
Drinking water that comes through the conventional piping system has low concentrations of lead, copper, zinc, and cadmium because those are left over or extracted from the pipes and the welds that hold the pipes together. And at these low concentrations, it's not deleterious.
Right. That would be bad.
Right.
Deleterious, bad.
Yeah.
All right.
So a healthy individual can drink, enjoy the flavors that these provide, and then expel.
All right. And on that, Larry, thanks for being on the program.
Yeah.
What, that's no witty comeback on that, Bill?
You
were giving me a goofy look.
It was a softball, so I can't, you know.
All right. So hopefully I'm going to get this right. We've tried for 3 weeks to get Haskell Beckham on here to use, I mentioned NMR before, nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, how to use that to follow sweat in athletic clothing. He will be here next week to talk about that very thing.
And happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving to everyone. And then I believe the following week we're going to have Dr. Mark Perlow, medical director of Georgia Reproductive Specialists, talking about new advances in infertility treatments.
We're going to get the athletic director.
Eventually, the athletic director has agreed to come on and talk about the trials and tribulations of having NCAA athletes at a science and technology school. You had a comment about that?
I was just going to say, go Jackets.
All right, there you go.
Saturday's game.
Not only Saturday's game, but three people on the space shuttle.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much for joining us here on Inside the Black Box. Hopefully, we'll see you next week on WREK Atlanta.